You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
We have about 20, 25 minutes for the floor to raise questions. We've had a number of both specific case studies that people might want to address, and I think also a series of broader issues about the political economy issues, about scaling up, about the political alliances, and I think particularly about the role of the state, where people seem still to be rather, at least from my perspective, a little bit too circumspect about the constructive role of the state in achieving overall development. But there's a lot of issues there that on the table. So I think people could introduce themselves and ask, and again, keep your questions short. We don't have a lot of time, so try and please keep your interventions to the point. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Karen Pape. I'm representing WIGO, which stands for Women in Informal Employment, Globalizing and Organizing. For me, in particular, interesting were the case studies on the street vendors and the waste pickers, because these are exactly the groups we are working with and who are members of WIGO. NASVI is a member of StreetNet International, and StreetNet International is a member of WIGO, and the Waste Pickers Alliance is a member of WIGO. And I just like to add two little things. The one is that the only international network of informal workers, namely StreetNet International, has adopted a resolution on its third Congress on the social and solidarity economy. And I'm inviting you to come to the WIGO stands after the session, and if you want, you can have a copy. Then I would like to add to the waste pickers presentation that, in fact, we can very proudly announce that the Bogota Waste Pickers Alliance, they won the bid last year of the municipality to do the entire waste collection for the city of Bogota. And this is not only for their own members, but also for the non-organized waste pickers. So this is the real kind of solidarity part of this. If time allows, and with my limited knowledge in terms of technical equipment with my computer, I would also like to show a film on the KKPKP and their initiative of the Swatch Cooperative downstairs. It's an eight-minute video, so whoever is interested. And of course, I'm inviting you all to my stand and would be looking forward to more discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for all of very valuable research and information. And I come from China. Just I'm very curious about the last topic is for the cooperation of agriculture cooperation, and actually in China we really have a unhappy history for such a kind of cooperation. And just now you mentioned that the recent boom of China agriculture cooperation. So would you please have some more explanation for this topic? Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, hello, my name is Patricia Muñoz and I represent Women in Development Europe. I wanted to address a question probably to all of you. It's if we are talking about solidarity and social economy, we have not discussed the structure of the market in which these types of initiatives could flourish. And also, what do we mean by rural economic development? I was very struck by the fact that we find these collective firms, cooperatives, difficult to manage. But is difficulty per se the reason why we should abandon the project? If it is transformative, that is one question. And to all of you, what would be some building blocks of a solidarity-based market that we could work towards?
If you can pick that up, and then maybe the panel can pick up particularly the last set of questions, which seem to be important to me.
Well, I'm not a specialist in Chinese cooperative, but what I know is that in 2007, the Chinese government enacted a new cooperative law, and after that, there has been a tremendous boom of agricultural cooperative in China. There are some particularities of the Chinese cooperative. One of them is that, for example, they have a much less democratic structure compared to what the cooperative International Cooperative Alliance will call a kind of ideal cooperative. For example, they are dominated by what they call core members. So there are core members that have much more shares of the enterprise compared to, let's say, the conventional normal members. And that's very abnormal in, for example, in other parts of the world, like in Latin America or in Africa, where you have one member, one vote, or equal distribution of shares among the members normally in cooperative. So it shows that cooperative are also very flexible organizational arrangements, and there is no one on blueprint for how cooperative should be, in despite what International Cooperative Alliance might say. And what is interesting is also in China is that this process has been very much led by the state or supported by the state and subsidized by the state, and where the state has had a very important influence in the way cooperatives have been configured and what kind of leadership they have, et cetera, et cetera. So probably it's too recent to assess what the history will be, this recent history of Chinese cooperative will be, this new generation of cooperative will be. What is interesting is that, well, what are the limits of state-led processes of cooperative promotion? And that's the overall question, not only for cooperative, but for all the type of social and solidarity in enterprises. And it's related to the other question. I mean, what does it mean social economic development? I mean, I think there is one clear component of rural development that's related to income, but there is another extremely important also a component related to the provision of public goods. And that's all the types of public goods, including health, education, et cetera, et cetera. And what you see in developing countries is that there is a trade-off between these two goals, the development goals. So the collective groups, I mean the collective firms that are mainly dealing with the provision of public goods, they perform very bad. I mean, I'm generalizing, but in the provision of income. So it doesn't mean that we have to abandon cooperative at all. I mean, that's not at all my point. My point is that you have to acknowledge this trade-off, and you have to acknowledge that you cannot maximize, and probably that's a point for discussion, that you cannot maximize efficiency and equity at the same time. That's what the evidence shows. Therefore, the conclusion might be, for example, is that you have to differentiate different type of farmers groups. So it would be reasonable to create farmers associations for the provision of public goods and not to mix them up with marketing organizations. I think that will be the most reasonable policy advice I will give to NGOs and governments is not try to mix up different services and different functions in one organization.
On the question of structure of market, I would say in the kind of paradigm we are having today, we do not have really control on the kind of structure of market. What we can have instead is to establish a linkage with the market to make the enterprises, SSC enterprises, flourish. So there are several possible ways to, you know, utilize the value chain to create market linkages. So basically, we cannot much influence the way market is because things are demand-driven and market-driven. So, but there are pooled way and institutional mechanisms which you kind of act as linkages between these enterprises and the market through which the, you know, commodities and services pass, so that, you know, the enterprises is not, you know, isolated, is mainstream through those linkages.
The market for the cooperatives, I could refer to the factory occupations in Argentina and how, you know, how complex the process was, and there was some state support for them to survive initially, but it's complicated because they end up like being against the project of self-management that they were there for. But I'd like to address the last question that you asked about some building blocks of solidarity-based market. You knew I was going to. I think just two ideas. One, I think in capitalism,
on the market economy, money is not just a means of exchange. And I think it has been a bit of a lack of debate about the meaning of money when we talk about alternative currencies as well. I see money as a fundamental social form that structures social life, and it's a power that structured also subjectivities and people and how we behave, and it's about abstract labor. It's abstracting the way we do things concretely into a substance of, you know, value, money, and profit making. So any alternative should try to deconstruct that. But the idea that comes to my mind is the idea of being singular, plural. I think the problem is the starting point. We start from the individual, then I am in solidarity with the others. I had to make an effort, and I think Krishli is a British philosopher. He works on this. I am an autonomous person, and it's the Kantian categorical imperative. Why would I be in solidarity with others? Well, because of moral obligation. You know, I am autonomous, but it's a moral obligation. Whereas in the being singular plural, the community is first, or the we are a plurality before. So in that is, for example, when the Zapatista says, detrás del pasamontañas estamos ustedes, which is difficult to translate, is behind the balaclava, we are you. It's difficult to tell. So the realization is communal, but also individual. So any action that heads in that direction for me would be the basis for some kind of alternative. Otherwise, I'm not sure how we can build something different, if that was the intention of your question, but this is all I can come up with.
I would like to add to what...
I would like to briefly to comment, first to thank for the questions. Regarding Colombia, and I think regarding the waste pickers, I think they have shown that when they formed alliance and the movements, that they are starting to change some things. They have access, or they have participated in the constitution of public policies, and they are now in several, in Brazil as well, several cooperatives now work with service delivery. So before, they picked up the waste and they sold it directly, so they were more vulnerable to the market actually, and to the intermediate sector. And now, whereas they're cooperatives, and these cooperatives are a national movement, now they can struggle for public policies and for service delivery. So now in several cities in Brazil and Colombia and India and other regions, they are paid for the service they deliver in the waste management system, especially the collection. And in some places, they also try to advance in the production chain, so to do some benefiting or production. Of course, when they commercialize, they still are very small and they sell to the big companies. So like I said, it's difficult for them to set out the rules. But then there are some experiences, for example, in Belo Horizonte, the several cooperatives, they joined, and actually at the state of Minas Gerais, and they formed a network of commercialization. And then they have a huge amount of recyclable material to sell, and then they can negotiate from another part. So if all of them separately want to sell, then they don't have really a chance. But as they work together, they also have a power, a negotiation power, not only towards the municipality, but also towards the companies they sell for. But of course, a lot of them have lack of capital, of equipment, so that means also that there should be public programs that support, or public investment, that support the equipment, that support the structure, the infrastructure of these cooperatives. And then just one other point, I think it also has to do with diversity. So for example in Gravataí, when they the cooperative, they had a contract with the municipality, and then there was a change of government, and then they were like several months, they didn't know if they would go, if the contract would still count for. And then they also formed coalitions, not only, they formed several coalitions, so for the unions and with other groups to push and to press the government, but they also formed coalitions with community groups. So then they do directly the collection door to door in the communities, in the schools, in the banks, with other organizations. So that's also a form how they can diversify where they act, and so they're less vulnerable to one actor.
I think at the back there, then here.
OK, Okay, thank you very much. I have a question for Ms. Deinerstein. First of all, I think you developed a very interesting model regarding the idea of prefigurative action. You apply that actually to the sector of the social economy, where in the praxis of collective action, it's a way of rethinking existing economic models, democratize economy. Could you make kind of relationship with other civil society actors, other social movements that have a similar kind of prefigurative action to democratize democracy? For instance, the Occupy movement, where actually the same idea applies to seeing their own collective action as a kind of laboratory for rethinking democracy. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'd like to, the thing that impresses me about what we're hearing, and I would invite the panelists to reflect on, I'm sorry, I'm David Barkin from Mexico. I would invite you to reflect on and include in the final versions of your documents a consideration of the way in which the activities that you're talking about are part of a process which in the dynamics leads to an extension and a broadening of the collective activities that are involved by these groups. One of the things that is very, very, it seems to me very important is the way in which communities, as they take greater control of them, of their process, also extend the range of the total part of their lives that they put under collective management. It seems to me to be particularly important in an analysis, and this goes back to the previous round of questions, an analysis that Samir Amin has offered of what's going on with a reinvigoration of the rural farm collective movement in China. Samir Amin is very, very optimistic about the strengthening and the importance of the strengthening of collective farming in China, the significance of the fact that the Chinese have not devolved land to be a private property, but to be to remain collective, and the importance that the new strength that he is observing in rural Chinese movements is leading to an integration of food production with an emphasis on food self-sufficiency with the processing and with community industrial or small-scale industrial activities that allow the communities to become much more vigorous and self-sufficient and much more effectively a part of what I think is being talked about here as the social and solidarity economy. This seems to me, and this was evident, I believe, perhaps I'm reading too much into your paper, Ana Cecilia, but this was very, very clear to me in the approach that you were offering. So I'd like to invite you to reflect on this.
Hi, I'm Stephen from the Beyond Zone, I think, at this hour. So I was just thinking about what Guy Ryder was saying yesterday about his concerns about the informal sector, that they are sort of the victims of economic casualization. And yet from the vantage point of the Beyond Zone, they also are potentially real practitioners of the solidarity economy. So I'm just wondering how you could respond to what Director Ryder was saying yesterday about the dangers in the informal.
Yeah, that's very interesting, actually. My take on regarding the dangers of informalization. Well, in the beginning of my presentation, I discussed that this is something, it's a reality which is not trivial and which is going to persist. We have not been able to, initially it was seen as a coping mechanism. Now it is no longer a coping mechanism. It has actually become a channel. There are many within the informal sector which are necessarily not as deprived, especially in the street trade sector, as we imagine that they could be. So to me, it's not a question of going, you know, kind of anti-marketization or, you know, warding off the process of informalization. Since it is going to persist, it's better to find out ways to mainstream them and enabling them to, you know, get accommodated in the process in terms of their own rights and spaces. So I hope I'm able to answer your question. Yeah.
Okay. With regard to the question of prefigurative action, I hope I'm not developing a model because that would be defeating my own purpose, but it's kind of an idea, yeah. Yes, Occupy Wall Street. I think it's a very interesting movement. So it also corroborates the idea that the movements are moving forwards from mere opposition to try to create something else. So, you know, we see that they work with consensus and horizontality and all the predicaments that are involved in that kind of development, which is not easy. But I will be careful when we compare. That's why I like the concept of hope, because the idea of the principle of hope, because when we put together the North and the South, or indigenous and urban and different kind of movements, we risk to, you know, produce some kind of a Eurocentric analysis, for example, radical democracy or horizontalism, yeah, or consensus among indigenous populations. If you go to any place in, you know, in Latin America, I don't think they feel that what they are doing is autonomous action. That word doesn't really count. So I found that sometimes we get this problem that we say, for example, that Zapatistas, they exercise radical democracy, which, or inventing something new. So for me, the idea of prefiguration is either creating something that is not there, but it could be not there because it has been made invisible. So in an indigenous community, they might be defending their habits or traditions that have been neglected and oppressed by years and years of, you know, colonial powers and et cetera, et cetera. So they are not really breaking the given or creating something new. So in that respect, you know, we can find lots of examples. The Occupy is an example of what I'm trying to say, that they are just organizing something is not there, and it's all about trial and error, and it's a space that is very promising, but hard and painful, and with lots of conflicts. It's not a La La Land. Professor Barkin, when you started your talking, I thought you were talking to the other speakers. So I kind of, when you said my name, I thought, okay. I understand that what you're saying is that more and more rural movements are taking over more spaces that are in charge of life, which is partly, it is buen vivir, for example, good life. So I think that is an amazing, you know, experience, but again, it's complicated and it's, but I am optimistic as well. Not because it's paradise, it's not the promise of, you know, perfect community, it's simply because it's a different way of approaching things. And I see, for example, the logic of when Bibir is penetrating the North through the World Social Forum. So here, it's not the same as well-being. We should translate it as good living, I suppose. Good living. And well-being is definitely within the paradigm of slow food, yeah, good life, like in the North. So I think this is a very, very important development. And the educational experiences are proof of that, how more and more aspects of, if this is what you were ask him, I apologize if I didn't tackle the question, and the dangers of the informal. Can you clarify that?
You know, I'm not sure that I can, but I just, it felt like one of those moments where we could produce diametrically opposed readings of how the informal worker is positioned with respect to either the neoliberal project or the solidarity economy project. So I was thinking that's why it's so important to be in that zone of indeterminacy, right? Yeah.
Conflict and categorizing people under different categories. So for the director of ILO law, obviously you got informal economies, which in Italy, for example, fits perfectly fine the normal economy, and the government has the discourse that, you know, the immigrants, the informal economy has to be eliminated, immigrants should go, but actually it works very well. So it's informal but integrated, but it's about institutionalizing. The Ministry of Labor in Argentina, the first, Tomada, I'm not sure he's in power still, but he said, I'd rather to have, I don't know how many strikes, 1,000 strikes, than having the piqueteros downstairs all day asking, because I don't know what they want. And I think it's about that, the indeterminacy. Obviously, if you occupy a position in an institution and you do have to do that, it's not. So I think, yeah, I think it is important not to classify, particularly because people don't feel like that. And there is, I will add this, I've used a bit the microphone, but sometimes I feel that there is a kind of reification. I'm risking, you know, I'm saying this, okay, I go for it, of the poor. Sometimes we really, what's the word? It's not that we need them, but we are all the time kind of classifying and trying to find the way. When people, you know, research, for example, Bevington does research did research in Peru and also in South Africa, and the results were people don't see themselves as the poor, they don't want to be called the poor. They say, yeah, they don't have what they need, obviously, but that category, it's not something they feel identified with. So that's my point, is we can't keep on going like that. We have to rethink how do we classify and things like that. So thanks for the question, yeah.
I will address rapidly the question about extension of the collective activities. I think when the waste pickers started, from the waste pickers example, when they started, one of the main motives was the economic motive. So how to survive. But then when they start to organize, they start to realize that there are a lot of other activities that are important as well, or maybe more important even. So from the waste picker, when they first start to organize and sell together their material and have one place together, then, for example, they started to take out the garbage from the house, and that makes a huge difference for the health of the waste pickers and for the health of their family. Then they also started to address with the child labor. So because when they do it at a house, then normally the children work together. Then when they start to work at a different workplace, then the children are another place. But then, of course, they had to worry about education, because then the children have to go to school. But then they have to have access to school. And then when they started to worry about that, then they start to worry about that most of them are illiterated. So they work with paper, but they couldn't even read what was written on the paper, or they couldn't even write their names. So then they start to ask for literacy programs. So as well as for a lot of the waste pickers were people who lived on the streets. So then, of course, when they start to organize and had a place to work, then they also want a place to live. So I think when the movements, the organizations, the collective organizations start to organize, then they see that there are a lot of demands that they should address. And then they see, whereas they would do it individually, they couldn't. But when they organize in a collective organization and in a social movement, then they have the power to address, either at the local municipality level, or when there are national movements, at the national level, or maybe even with a global alliance at the global level. So I think I'll just leave mine for you. No, thank you very much.
Last word for you.
A short comment about, I mean, think we should distinguish between with the property rights and collective action. I think you can engage in collective action with private property rights, and with property rights, you can have also community property rights and estate property rights. And I think, personally, I don't think that. There are many paradoxes of state-owned land in both in China or in Ethiopia, for example. When in Ethiopia you have large-scale land-grabbing processes, or in China you have large-scale displacement of farmers, because the land is owned by the state and the state has, all the right to make with farmers whatever they want. So I don't think that there are good examples of how a collective action should be promoted by the state, but definitely there is a relationship between the role of the state and collective action, and this is a very delicate relationship. I mean, how to create policies to promote collective action and at the same time not to mingle too much on collective action, because we already know for a very long history that forced collaboration is the worst thing you can get. I mean, it will never work, forced collaboration. I mean, you always should aim at autonomous collaboration of agents. That's I think that history already had taught us that this should be the way.
Look, I mean, as Groucho Marx said, time flies like an arrow, fruit flies like a banana, and I think we're cutting into banana time right now, as I think most people are quite tired and would like a coffee. I'm not going to try and summarize the discussion this afternoon. I think there's a lot of fascinating case studies that I've certainly learned a lot from. I think there's also a lot of unresolved questions of a more structural nature for fairly traditional development economists like myself, I think the conversation continues. But let me simply conclude by thanking the four panelists for their excellent presentations this afternoon, and also to the audience for listening and for raising, I think, a number of pertinent questions. Thank you very much.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unris.org. Thank you for listening.